Amos Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments involving two cases related to same-sex marriage. On Tuesday, the focus was on California's Proposition 8, which bans same-sex marriage in the state. At issue is whether this ban violates the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal protection under the law. Then on Wednesday, the court turned to the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, which prohibits same-sex couples from receiving the same federal benefits that heterosexual married couples get, and there are more than 1,000 of them. In this hour of Radio Times, we get reaction and analysis of these hearings, and we have two guests, one of whom joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Tobias Barrington-Wolf is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. He served as chief advisor on lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues in the 2008 presidential campaign of Barack Obama. And Tobias, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
And on the telephone is Edward Whalen. He's a president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and he clerked for Justice Scalia about 20 years ago. And Ed Whalen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
Tobias, let me begin with you, and I do want to hear from you as well, Ed. Just looking broadly at what happened this week, no matter where you come down on these two particular cases, was this a historic week at the U.S. Supreme Court?
Oh, I think there's no question about that. This was the first time that the Supreme Court has heard argument on the question of marriage equality in the California case and the question of the federal treatment of married gay couples in the Defense of Marriage Act case. And whatever the court decides, or even if the court winds up not deciding these cases on the merits, which is a possibility that we can get into, I think that having the formal presentation of these arguments before the court, seeing the court respond to them on the merits, seeing the way in which the court's mind or the individual justices' minds appear to be working, it's a very important moment. And of course, it focuses the nation's attention. That's one of the capacities that the Supreme Court has, is to focus attention on legal issues. And I think that this, whatever the outcome of these cases, this will be remembered as an important moment.
And Ed, these were, of course, back-to-back cases, which even heightened the focus on these issues. Do you agree with Tobias?
Well, I certainly agree that the court's oral arguments this week were part of an ongoing national debate about same-sex marriage. I very much hope the court recognizes the importance of letting that robust debate that's going on proceed, and that it doesn't interrupt it by rulings that would create a federal constitutional right to same-sex marriage. But sure, it's significant that these cases are up there. The court, of course, granted in order to review rulings below that struck down the Defense of Marriage Act and California's Proposition 8. So it's a good thing that the cases are up there.
Let me just pick up on that, and Edwin, I'll go back to you. And I'm certainly not an expert of the court, but I did listen to most of the arguments. And it seemed in both of these cases, the beginning of the arguments were all procedural questions. You know, who's allowed to present this case? Who is representing whom when it comes to these cases? Ed, is that unusual?
Well, it is unusual, and it results from the unusual fact that in both cases, the government officials charged with defending the laws failed to carry out their duties. And that creates, in each case, interesting questions of standing and jurisdiction. The questions in the two cases are different. They overlap some. It's possible the court may decide them the same. It's possible that it may decide them differently. But yes, again, the fact that the Obama administration refused to defend the Defense of Marriage Act after it initially at least pretended to, and the fact that California state officials refused to defend the state initiative that was designed to get around their own obstruction is significant and explains why these issues were front and center.
Well, Tobias, let me go back to you and even go back to Proposition 8, which was argued on Tuesday. Again, it said that marriage could only be between a man and a woman recognized in that state. Now, 52% of the public voted for this in 2008. It was declared unconstitutional by a U.S. District Court judge, by a federal appeals court. California did not defend Proposition 8 in the court this week. Is it a kind of orphan issue when it comes to at least the California judicial and government system?
Well, you know, The occasions when I usually come in to talk to you about legal developments tend to relate to constitutional issues. In my life as a law professor, I spend most of my time on procedure, civil procedure in the federal courts and primarily. And so I view these procedural issues as fascinating and very important. I'm not going to inflict too much of a detailed discussion on you or your audience. But I think the procedural issue in the California case is a very serious one. The state of California defended the constitutionality of Prop 8 before the federal district court. And when the federal district court declared the provision unconstitutional, the state accepted that outcome and said, we're not going to take an appeal from that decision. And that's actually something that happens. You know, it's not an unheard of thing at all for a government to accept a ruling at a trial court level and not pursue an appeal. But another party or set of parties sought to appeal, which were the private citizens who had put Prop 8 on the ballot in the first place. And so the question that got put before the courts in that case was, do they have the so-called standing to pursue an appeal when they're not the government? And that it was a question that went back and forth a lot. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals actually asked for input from the California Supreme Court on one aspect of that question. And to make a long story short, the Ninth Circuit said, yes, given California law on ballot initiatives, these private parties can pursue this appeal. And so the Supreme Court now has to decide whether that was correct. And I think it's a very serious question whether the federal standards for who gets to pursue an appeal are satisfied in this case. And if the court winds up deciding the case on that basis, it actually creates a complicated state of affairs on the ground, and there'll be more work required to figure out what that means for the rest of the citizens of California. The procedural question in the DOMA case.
I'm sorry. Could I offer one comment?
Yeah, please, go ahead, Ed, and then we'll get back and we'll get to DOMA. Go ahead, Edward.
Yes, the state officials were nominal defendants in the district court case in Prop 8, but Tobias is mistaken in saying that they actually defended DOMA. Defended Prop 8. Mm-hmm. They failed to defend from the very beginning. And that's important because it may relate to what the consequences of a lack of standing would be. It may be that there was never sufficient adversity in the first place. I agree it's a complicated question, but I did want to highlight that it's not the case that California officials ever actually defended Proposition 8.
And I don't want to get too into the weeds, knowing, of course, how important the weeds are. Do you want to say anything back to that, Tobias?
I appreciate that. I appreciate that correction, and Ed is quite correct about that. One tries to keep these details in one's head, but every once in a while one trips up. But, you know, the basic question in the Prop 8 case on procedural grounds is whether a private person can be deputized to essentially advance the interests of the state in federal litigation, mm-hmm. and what possible constitutional limitations there might be on that kind of designation. And that's the question in front of the court, and I think it's a very serious one. In the DOMA case, the issue, the procedural issue comes up in a very different posture.
Can you hold on to the DOMA?
Sure.
Only because I'm trying to keep up with the two of you.
Sure.
And I do want to focus a couple more questions on Proposition 8. And Edward Whalen, if I can go back to you. Something that Justice Kagan said to the attorney Cooper, who was representing this group of people in California, saying, how would same-sex marriage harm the institution of marriage or opposite-sex couples? What was Cooper's response, and what was Cooper trying to tell the court?
Well, I think what Chuck Cooper explained to the court is that the institution of marriage has developed and exists primarily because of the strong interest that societies have in ensuring maximizing the likelihood that children are raised by the fathers and mothers who brought them into existence. The opposite-sex nature of marriage inheres in the very nature of marriage when one recognizes this fact. And I think that was at the core of what he was explaining.
Well, going back to you, Tobias, and there was an interesting interchange with Kagan and Cooper about people marrying over their age of 50. But his argument seemed to be that marriage is at its core about procreation.
That was a lot of his argument. It was actually a very interesting feature of his presentation, and I think Ed kind of touched on this a bit, that he was arguing that marriage is defined in terms of the sex or the gender of people who are allowed to participate in the in this state institution, and that we should in fact think of this as a gendered institution. I think that's a term that he used. And that raises an interesting question, which is that quite apart from questions about discrimination based on sexual orientation, it's very well established that classifications or discrimination based upon sex raise all kinds of constitutional concerns. They don't always violate the Constitution. The court has upheld a few classifications on sex. But for the most part, the court has found that when a state or the federal government draws its laws in terms of the sex of its citizens, that that requires intense constitutional scrutiny. And so insofar as the court views laws that restrict who gets to get married on the basis of the sex of the two participants in the relationship, that could mobilize a very different kind of constitutional response. And Mr. Cooper seemed to acknowledge the proposition that what he referred to as gendered marriage laws might constitute classifications based on sex. Now, I take it that his position would be they're justified because of this procreation argument, but that was an interesting moment in the argument.
And going back to Edward Whalen, Justice Kennedy, in these arguments, asked questions about the some 40,000 children being raised by gay and lesbian couples, asking, don't they deserve the kind of protection that the children of heterosexual married couples get?
Well, Justice Kennedy made one comment to that effect, which immediately followed his comment that it's impossible to say that same-sex marriage wouldn't have wouldn't impose serious damage on the institution of marriage, because we simply can't tell things like that. So I think there's been inordinate attention given to his, on the other hand, comment. But look, certainly in the calculus, the policy calculus on whether states ought to adopt same-sex marriage, the question of children being raised by same-sex couples is one factor. Mm-hmm. As the Chief Justice later pointed out in the same argument, there's a bit of a tension, shall we say, between the claims of same-sex marriage advocates that kids raised by gay couples, whether or not married, are doing just fine by the measure of supposed social science, and the claim at the same time that they're somehow harmed seriously by the denial of the word marriage.
Well, I want to take a very short break and pick up on that very point. The American Academy of Pediatrics has weighed in on this issue. We are talking about the two same-sex marriage issues that were argued before this week before the U.S. Supreme Court. Talking with Edward Whalen and Tobias Barrington Wolf, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
For 19 years, the Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show has brought together patrons and artisans. Once again, the show is downtown at the 23rd Street Armory on 23rd Street, just south of Market, and runs from Friday evening, April 5th, to Sunday the 7th. Featuring modern and traditional tables, chairs, beds, textiles, lighting, and tabletop items. PIFS supports WHYY. More info at philaifs.com. The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show. Art you can live with.
You know that feeling you get when you hear a song that you just love? What about a new movie or a new book or a TV show? I'm Jesse Thorne. My show Bullseye points to the good stuff in popular culture, the kind of stuff that will change your life. In-depth interviews with cultural creators, critics' picks for the best new releases, and a weekly recommendation from yours truly. It's Bullseye with me, Jesse Thorne, from MaximumFun.org and PRI.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Abington Health supports WHYY and offers minimally invasive procedures designed to help people overcome strokes and brain aneurysms. Physicians use interventional techniques through small incisions to help speed recovery. Patient stories at abingtonpowertoheal.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about the fact that this week the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in two cases related to same-sex marriage, one from California, Proposition 8, and one a federal law that was signed by President Clinton in 1996, the Defense of Marriage Act. 1-888-477-9499. And our guests are Edward Whalen, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Also with us, Tobias Barrington-Wolf, and he's a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. Picking up on what we were talking about right before the break, the American Academy of Pediatrics is in support of same-sex marriage. They came out on that earlier. Go ahead, Tobias.
Yeah, I think there are three points that it's worthwhile to put on the table in discussions about kids around marriage and marriage equality. The first is that the discussion is not about whether gay parents are going to exist. Gay parents exist, and gay and lesbian couples have kids either in their relationship, they bring kids into the relationship, or they have kids from before they became partnered. And the public policy question, and also at least in some respects the constitutional question, is not do we want there to be gay and lesbian parents, but rather, what does it make sense to do in making equal support and equal protection available to these parents and their kids? And also, of course, in the context of these lawsuits, what is it constitutional to do when it comes to either extending or denying equal treatment to these parents? And that's important, I think, because these conversations often seem to unfold against this implicit suggestion that we're talking about whether these people and their families should exist at all. And that's not what we're talking about. A second point on the question of the state of the social science. The social science data on the capacity of gay and lesbian parents to be equally successful in raising their kids goes back several decades. And like much social science in the field of child rearing, it is difficult work to do and it's imperfect in many ways. But what is significant about it is that it all points in one direction. Which is that holding all other things equal, there's simply no reason to believe that two parents who happen to be of the same sex are going to be any more or less successful in raising their kids than two parents who are of opposite sex. And the third thing, the point that Ed raised about the Chief Justice's argument that, well, you're saying on the one hand that there are harms to kids when their parents can't get married, but on the other hand, you're arguing that the social science data says that they do okay. I'll be honest to say it was a clever debating point. I don't think it had a lot of substance to it. The social science data are measuring broad indices of successful development, and they are, you know, necessarily taking a sort of broad brush approach to the question: are these kids happy? Are these kids well socialized? Are they exhibiting antisocial behaviors and so forth? The questions that arise when kids of gay and lesbian parents are denied equal treatment and their parents are denied equal treatment, I don't think it's necessary to argue that this is going to have sort of dramatic impacts upon their social development to recognize that it's a harm when a kid is told that his family is not an equal member of the social community and that his parents are not really committed to each other in the same way as the parents of his or her friends who happen to be straight instead of gay. And so, you know, the chief is welcome to raise the question, obviously, but I don't think it had quite as much bite to it as has been suggested.
I do want to move on to DOMA, and I do want to get some callers in as well. And
may I please at least respond briefly?
Absolutely, yes. Go ahead.
Yes. The social science here is schlock science. It's shot through as one reviewer of it wrote, with conceptual and methodological flaws, small, non-random, convenient samples, a recurring lack of control groups, shifting and poorly defined outcomes, and a steady pattern of comparing apples to oranges.
And what are you referring to? I'm just curious.
I'm sorry? I'm referring to a review that a peer-reviewed paper that reviewed by Lauren Marks of LSU that reviewed the 59 studies that the APA has cited in support of its supposed judgment. Now, so this is not, I mean, one looks carefully at this. I'm not saying social science speaks to the matter the other way. I think it simply doesn't speak to it at all. I think it's beyond the capacity of social science, given the very limited data available, to speak meaningfully to it. But even Tobias wasn't comparing, if you notice, he wasn't comparing the kids raised by gay couples to what social science recognizes as the gold standard, a marriage between the biological father and mother. He's simply comparing it to, you know, raised by two heterosexual parents.
Let me just jump in here, only because this is not APA, but the American Academy of Pediatrics. They came out in favor of legalizing same-sex marriage. The group looked at something like 80 studies. They looked at articles and books that have been conducted over something like 30 years, concluding that legalized same-sex marriage would strengthen families and benefit children. That's the American Academy of Pediatrics.
And they're relying on the same studies, and there simply isn't any serious science on these questions. It would take decades to have social science findings that one could credit seriously, which is why people can draw their own reasonable inferences. They can weigh this in different ways, and this is a matter that ought to be left to democratic processes to decide.
Well, let me give you, and I don't want to, this is a very important issue, obviously, and I want to give you, Tobias, a chance to respond if you'd like to.
Sure, thank you. Ed is choosing to adopt a very aggressive posture in this conversation, which is fine, and I apologize if I was at all unclear. The studies indeed attempt to compare, as it were, apples to apples. They attempt to hold all other questions equal and to determine whether it makes a difference if a same-sex couple, if a couple raising kids is a same-sex couple or an opposite-sex couple. And these studies are indeed imperfect because studying people's families and kids is a difficult endeavor. And it is correct to say that it's difficult to get these studies that don't have selection problems, that don't have non-representativity problems. And that's true whether you're studying straight families or families with straight parents or families with gay parents. All of the major professional organizations that attempt to do this kind of work have come to the conclusion that where kids do best when they're raised by parents who have a strong relationship with each other, parents who are invested in raising their children and have good relations with their kids, and who have the resources available to provide for their kids. And that those are the primary drivers of success for kids in a household, and they play out the same way whether the parents are gay or straight.
Well,
I would simply invite listeners who are interested in this issue to review the amicus brief that Leon Cass and Harvey Mansfield submitted that discusses the nature of the social science today.
And I'd also like to make one more point, if I may, which is that this argument that we aren't 100% confident that all things being equal, gay couples who get married are going to be just as successful with their kids as straight couples. Even if one accepts that premise, and as I say, I reject it, and I think that the weight of evidence rejects it, there are all kinds of married couples who have much greater challenges in raising their kids. Married couples who have inadequate access to resources, right? Poor parents, for example. Maybe the most devoted parents in the world, the fact that they're poor is going to make it harder for them to have successful outcomes with their kids. And in most, if not all, other areas, our public policy response to a married couple that may face challenges in raising their kids is not to say, well, you can't get married anymore. It's to say, how can we support you in your ability to best raise your children? And I must admit, I've never understood. Once again, if you acknowledge that gay and lesbian people exist and gay and lesbian parents exist, why is it an argument for excluding them from the institution that the state makes available to support couples and families to posit some kind of extra challenge that they may have in raising their kids? It's not true on the facts, but even if there were any truth to it, one would think the appropriate public policy response would be to say, how can we support these families?
Go ahead, go ahead, Ed Whalen.
Yeah, I think there's an important point that's being missed. Again, I readily acknowledge that on the policy question, the interests of kids being raised by gay couples is a factor that needs to be assessed and evaluated. The concern is that if you deinstitutionalize marriage and define it in law away from its focus on the kids of raised in opposite-sex marriages, you tell people in marriage that marriage isn't about raising kids. and you contribute to and make permanent the collapse of the marriage culture in this country that has so many kids in such horrible situations, and that I think really threatens, when you see what more than 40% of kids are born out of wedlock with all this, with all the attendant social pathologies, really threatens the survival of this country.
Well,
so my point isn't that one should discount the interests of kids being raised by gay couples. It's that one needs to focus on the far greater risk to lots more kids if marriage is deinstitutionalized.
I'm very happy to allow to stand on its own the suggestion that extending same-sex couples equal access to the civil institution of marriage threatens the existence of this country. I will simply allow your listeners to judge that remark on its own.
And that's Tobias Barrington-Wolf. He's a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. He also served as the chief advisor on lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues. This was for President, then-candidate Obama's presidential campaign of 2008. Edward Whalen, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He also clerked for Justice Scalia some 20 years ago. We are talking about the two cases that were argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, of course, raising a whole host of issues. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Tobias, just based on what you just said there, and we've been focusing on the court, but what's interesting is while the court is debating these issues, it looks like the public has moved in a more majority direction when it comes to this issue of gay marriage. What do you make of that?
That does appear to be the case. I think a certain amount of caution is warranted in making drawing broad conclusions about public sentiment, but the polling seems to suggest a consistent direction of greater acceptance of equal treatment for same-sex couples. And, of course, the last election cycle was significant. It was the first occasion on which the right of same-sex couples to be married was ratified by the voters in Maryland and Washington, and an attempt to write a discriminatory provision into a state constitution was defeated. It was the second time that had happened, but it was consequential in the state of Minnesota. So that is certainly measurable progress. But I think it would be a mistake to suggest that this is an issue that we as a society have reached a major consensus on. I think that we are moving in that direction, but there, debate mm-hmm. continues.
Well, I do want to get some callers in and someone speaking to what we've been talking about. This is Barbara from Ardmore. Barbara, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling in about the label marriage because Chief Justice Roberts raised it at one point in that discussion you've been talking about. He said, well, is it just the label that is the sticking point? And for many people, I think it is. Here's what I think he did, though. He used an analogy that was really unfortunate. He said, if you force somebody to be your friend, then you change the definition of friendship. And I thought, oh, we're not forcing anybody to do anything in marriage, but we are expanding the circle of who could be included in the definition of marriage. Just the way in the 50s, most people might, little children wouldn't have thought a black child could be their friend, or later gay children couldn't be their friends. We're just expanding the circle of who belongs to the term. I think the term is about two people who are committed into a loving and familial relationship.
Well, Barbara, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Ed Whalen, I'm tossing that first to you. Go ahead.
Well, it's not simply an expansion. It's a radical redefinition. And indeed, the caller's own redefinition would extend, for example, to adult incest. Now, I'm not saying that the issues as a policy matter are at all the same, but I think we ought to face up to the fact that when you define marriage away from what it's always been, and say that there's a right to marry a person of the same sex, that is a very, very different definition of marriage.
But
different understanding of what the mission of marriage is.
But what does that have to do with incest?
I was making the point that the caller's own definition of marriage, I think she said a loving relationship between two people,
right,
is expansive enough to include adult incest, which just goes to the question, the slippery slope question, you know, is there any limiting principle to the constitutional arguments that the other side makes? Surely, again, as a policy matter, there are sharp distinctions that could be made, and I wouldn't want to be misunderstood as suggesting otherwise. But what we're talking about is whether marriage would be radically redefined, and in that radical redefinition, be turned away from what has long been understood to be its central mission.
Go ahead, Tobias.
So let me say a couple of words about the myth of the definition, which is often introduced into these conversations. First of all, marriage as a civil legal institution has changed dramatically. Its definition has changed dramatically during the course of American history. There were significant periods of time when marriage was defined in terms of the rights and prerogatives of men, to the exclusion of the rights and prerogatives of women, whose personhood disappeared or was covered by the identity of the man in the marriage, and women lost a lot of rights when they got married. More recently, marriage was defined in ways that diminished the ability of a woman to refuse consent when it comes to sexual relations, and women were not able to resist rape in a marriage. It was legally impossible to do so. We could talk a bit about divorce law and changes in the ability of people to decide to dissolve a marriage. There have been significant changes in the definition of marriage that had a real impact, and I think in many ways a good impact. Some people would also argue in the case of divorce laws a bad impact, but a real impact on the lives of straight married couples. And so one aspect of this conversation that somehow there has been this invariant definition of marriage, which is suddenly now being opened up, is respectfully incorrect.
Well,
second, let me just, if I may, let me just
Ed.
Make a second point, which is that I have never, and I think most people who are advocates of marriage equality, have never relied upon purely formal arguments about why it is that same-sex couples ought to be given equal access to the civil institution of marriage. And if we really need to have a conversation about incest or about polygamy or all of these other parade of horribles that opponents of marriage equality often provide, we can have that conversation. And there are obviously real and significant differences between those types of arrangements and the relationships of loving gay and lesbian couples. And it is not a definitional exercise to talk about why gay and lesbian citizens in the United States should be given equal treatment under law. It is a discussion which is about their equal humanity and the equal capacity of their relationships to provide social goods and to provide goods to the people involved in the relationship.
We do need to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Tobias Barrington-Wolf and Edward Whalen. We are talking about the two cases that were argued this week before the U.S. Supreme Court related to to the issue of same-sex marriage. And we've been talking a lot about marriage, what it is, what it isn't. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Ed, I'll give you a chance to respond after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
For 19 years, the Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show has brought together patrons and artisans. Once again, the show is downtown at the 23rd Street Armory on 23rd Street, just south of Market, and runs from Friday evening, April 5th to Sunday the 7th. Featuring modern and traditional tables, chairs, beds, textiles, lighting, and tabletop items. PIFS supports WHYY. More info at philaifs.com. The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show. Art you can live with.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Frank Langella. He says he got rid of his native New Jersey accent as a kid, listening to legendary British actor John Gielgud's albums and imitating his voice.
And pretty soon I sounded like, you know, in the middle of Bayonne, New Jersey, here comes this little British lord.
Frank Langella's film Robot and Frank is out on DVD. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Abington Health supports WHYY and offers minimally invasive procedures designed to help people overcome strokes and brain aneurysms. Physicians use interventional techniques through small incisions to help speed recovery. Patient stories at abingtonpowertoheal.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, again talking with Edward Whalen and Tobias Barrington-Wolf, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Ed, from your argument, are you also arguing that when the Supreme Court made its Loving decision back in 1967, basically saying that different states tried to make marriage between that marriage was illegal in a number of states if the couple was interracial, that the court essentially said to the states that is illegal, that interracial couples are allowed to marry. Are you also questioning that decision by the court? Because that certainly did change the institution of marriage.
I'm not questioning that at all, and I'm afraid that my whole argument here is being mischaracterized. Let me be clear. First of all, as Justice Kennedy pointed out when Ted Olson tried to make the same comparison to Loving, marriage existed for centuries in the Anglo-American tradition without these ugly racial restrictions. Anti-miscegenation laws were an exception to what marriage had always been understood to be, an imposition of a racial classification on top of marriage. By contrast, the male-female nature of marriage has inhered in what it's always been. Now, I actually agree with most of what Tobias had to say in his long answer before the break. I disagree with him in two respects. First, I'm not advocating an invariant definition of marriage. It is entirely open to the political processes to redefine marriage. The question is whether it is prudent to do so. And secondly, insofar as he is suggesting that redefining marriage to include a right to marry a person of the same sex isn't a radical redefinition that wouldn't have real consequences to what marriage is, I disagree as well.
But it sounds like you do agree with the fact that the marriage has changed over the decades, perhaps even centuries.
Of course, but throughout and again, of course, it can change more. But the one aspect that has been recognized in every society, and that frankly was accepted by and understood by sociologists and anthropologists across the ideological spectrum until it became fashionable recently to deny it, is that the male-female nature of marriage lies at the very core of the reason for its existence.
Go ahead,
if we change marriage to simply ratifying some sort of effective relationship between adults, what possible reason is there for government to get involved in that? Are we going to have government inquiring on whether you actually love someone enough? That's not what marriage has been about. Marriage has been about providing the best possible vehicle for raising children. That's been a central mission of it. And if we define marriage away from a male-female union, we're going to have mission confusion that further does terrible damage to children. And yes, I do believe that the future of this country is at risk if the collapse of the marriage culture that heterosexuals are responsible for isn't turned around.
But what's interesting, Tobias, is that you've got heterosexual couples who don't have children, and I know Clarence and Ginny Thomas don't have children, and you've got gay and lesbian couples who do have children. And I mean, when you factor in the children issue, it raises a whole host of questions.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't want to get into commenting on the personal lives of members of the court, but I guess I'll just say this. Your audience should ask themselves the question, how do all of these arguments take into account the real lives of real people? And does it take into account the real lives of approximately 10 million gay and lesbian Americans and their kids to simply define them out of state laws that are designed to offer them protection and offer them assistance and support? And does it take into account the real lives of straight Americans to say that they will cease being invested in their own marriages and that the future of this country is at risk if we extend equal treatment under our civil marriage laws to their gay and lesbian brothers and sisters? And I just pose that question.
Let me see.
I think those are false questions.
Well, hold on. And we could go back and forth here. We got a lot of callers in, and I do want to get them. We'll have a chance to go back and forth. But first, let's see what Paul from Ardmore has to say. Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Morning.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Professor Whalen sort of cut the legs out of most of what I was going to say by pointing out that historically marriage has not been about the production of children. It's been about the transfer of property, i.e. the woman and what she could bring with her. And that's been true throughout the centuries. To the extent that it is involved appropriation, it's about the appropriation of a male heir to prevent further division of the family property. The question that I'd have to ask is, why do we in this country persist in having marriage as a one-part process performed in a church rather than, as is done in most of the rest of the world, a two-part process where you go to City Hall, get married by the city and certified by the state, and then you go across the street to the church to get blessed?
Well, I mean, in certain ways, we sort of do have that, but let me see what Ed Whalen has to say, and then Tobias, looks like you want to add to that as well. Ed, go ahead.
Well, on the latter part, my understanding, which may be mistaken, is that we do have the two-part system, and just in many cases, the minister is licensed to perform the civil role as well. But again, if Tobias may know this better than I do. On the first part, I'm afraid that the caller's understanding of the purpose of marriage is simply false. You have folks like Bertrand Russell, you know, anthropologist Claude Levi-Strauss and sociologist King Lee Davis, who have recognized, as everyone did until it became convenient not to, the central connection between marriage and responsible procreation and childrearing. The fact that there are these incidental property consequences is not why marriage has arisen and exists.
Go ahead.
So the caller is... I think, well educated in the history of the institution of marriage. Marriage has indeed often been about control over property. And let me also just mention, people involved in these debates frequently say rather casually that throughout the history of the world and all societies, there's been this understanding that marriage is about one man and one woman. And in fact, if one wants to talk about traditional definitions or practices of marriage, the practice of polygamy is widespread and certainly historically and also to this day. And polygamy is often raised as this horrible consequence that advocates of marriage equality need to somehow answer to. But in fact, the idea that there is one man and one woman in an egalitarian marriage in which they are equally participating and equally sharing child-rearing duties and so forth is a very recent innovation and not at all the historic or worldwide understanding of the institution.
Let's see.
I agree with Tobias, which is why I did not refer to – I did not say history is all – the history of marriage has always
been – You said all societies, Ed. You said all societies.
I said male, female. I did not say one man and one woman.
Ah, okay.
And the point
so your definition of marriage, which you're seeking to defend here, is equally applicable to polygamous marriages. That's your position.
So, Tobias, once again, you misrepresent my argument.
I'm sorry. I'm trying very hard to understand your argument.
Well, perhaps if you let me speak a little more, you'd be able to.
Hold on. Go ahead.
The male-female component of marriage is at the core of what marriage is. Polygamy is indeed, as you point out, not a slippery slope consequence of same-sex marriage, because polygamy is upslope of same-sex marriage. Historically, it's been, as you point out, a common variation of marriage, and of course, I think the distinction between two and three is far more arbitrary than the distinction between male and female on the one hand and male on the other.
Let me get looks like Ken from Lansdale to join us on Radio Times. Ken, go ahead. You're on the air. That would be yes. Ken, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Question about DOMA. If the Supreme Court does overturn the relevant section of DOMA, I was under the impression that a same-sex couple could travel to another state, get legally married, and then the federal government would recognize that marriage that was legally performed. But it turns out, I maybe have been wrong about that, the couple actually has to live in that state. Could you clarify or comment on that, please?
Let me see if Tobias could take that.
It's a very good question, and there's not a simple answer. If the court strikes down so-called Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act, what is clear is that couples who live in states where they're allowed to get married, their marriages will be treated equally for federal purposes as well as state purposes. Mm-hmm. What is much less clear is if you have a couple in a state like Pennsylvania, for example, who cannot get married, who travel someplace, get married, and then return home, generally speaking, those marriages will not be recognized by their home state. There are perhaps one or two exceptions. But
not
Pennsylvania.
The federal government.
No, I understand. Let me just. Okay. So the home state, if the home state is not recognizing the marriage, a question then arises, would the federal government recognize the marriage even if the home state does not? And in the absence of some kind of direction from Congress on that score, if the court strikes down DOMA, I think that the federal courts will have to develop some kind of, I suppose it would be a federal common law answer to that question. And I think there are legitimate questions about what the right answer would be in that circumstance.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
I agree with what Tobias just said. I would highlight that Harvard Law Professor Noah Feldman, who is a strong supporter of same-sex marriage, has warned about the legal chaos and nightmarish barrage of new litigation that would result if DOMA is struck down on the federalism grounds, the confused federalism grounds that some people are advocating. I think that would be, you'd end up with this very weird result that in fact wouldn't serve interests of federalism and would be chaotic. But I basically agree with how Tobias has outlined the matter.
Well,
and
he may not quite agree.
Well,
with
no,
you.
It's
Go
interesting.
Ahead. Ahead.
Noah Feldman is a good friend of mine, the question of whether the court addresses itself to federal power as opposed to equal protection in a decision striking down DOMA, if in fact that's what it does. That's a separate question from the question the caller posed, which is what would happen to couples who live in states where they're not allowed to get married but travel someplace and get married. If the court chooses a federal power basis for striking down DOMA, I think it is quite correct to say that that will raise a whole host of new and very difficult questions about all kinds of other statutes totally outside the realm of marriage. But that's a very separate question.
Let me go back to you, Ed William, because you talk about the male-female relationship or the male-female marriage as a kind of gold standard. But we also, we know from the divorce rate that many marriages do not work out. We know about problems that can happen within heterosexual married couples that Tobias talked about, some of the economic problems people can have. We can also talk about child rearing that may be not up to the kind of gold standard that we want in heterosexual marriages. It seems like what you're describing is something ideal. What I'm talking about is something, how people really live their lives.
Well, there's no question that we have had a serious collapse of our marriage culture in this country, a collapse, I repeat, that is almost entirely the responsibility of heterosexuals. The question is whether we are going to perpetuate that collapse by redefining marriage away from its central mission of procreation, responsible procreation and child rearing, or whether we are going to at some point tend to that task so that we are able to do a better job of raising people who have the capacity to be responsible citizens.
But if you've got committed gay couples who want to get married and want to take good care of their children, how does that hurt a heterosexual marriage or even the institution of heterosexual marriage?
The entrenchment in law of the notion that marriage has nothing to do with procreation, that the female-male nature of marriage is obsolete, defines marriage away from that central mission. And anytime you have mission confusion, an institution will perform a mission less well.
But you've got gay couples who are adopting. You have lesbians who are getting pregnant and having children. I mean, that is procreation, yes?
Well, it's not procreation, though. It is obviously generating children. But Marty, as I've said several times already, I certainly agree that there are interests there that weigh in the policy balance.
Right.
I don't think that it's right to consider them somehow predominant, but different people can weigh that differently. That's a policy matter that we ought to be deciding through our democratic processes.
Well, and we only have a minute and a half here, Tobias. We've been talking sort of around these two cases that were argued before the Supreme Court. Do you think, no matter what the court decides, that this will settle this issue in any way?
That's an interesting question.
And it could
question.
Go in so many different directions. I understand that.
I mean, I guess here's what I'll say about that. Ed has accused me several times of mischaracterizing his argument respecting the harm to the institution of marriage, and I don't want to mischaracterize his argument. I will admit that I have tried and failed to understand his argument. The challenges that committed couples have in raising their kids are real, and I think the role of the state is to support and to provide for families so as to maximize the chances that all of us will be better off in having parents who can successfully raise their kids. And I think that's equally true for gay and lesbian couples and their kids. And I think when the state draws distinctions between couples based upon sex or sexual orientation, that raises very serious questions under the Equal Protection Clause. Now, however the court decides these cases in front of it, is that going to settle the large debates about how people should be approaching their own families? Absolutely not, and that's not the role of the court. Is it possible that the court will help to move us to a greater sense of the equal citizenship status of gay and lesbian people? That is possible, and we'll have to see what the court does.
Well, to be continued, Tobias Barrington-Wolf, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania, Edward Whalen, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And he's the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm sure there's a conversation taking place on our Facebook page. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us, and stay with us. We'll be right back. Coming up next, the story.